You want to try it? Or
oh, sure. You do it now? Yeah, we can.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, hi. My name is Sebastian Lusarder, and I'm the cider maker at Flag Hill Farm in central Vermont, in Verscher, Vermont. Oh, you're listening to Cider Chat.
Episode 44. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Aria Wincoller, and I am your Cider MC. On this weekly podcast, where we are speaking to cider makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we are indeed headed back to Vermont to catch up with Sebastian Lusarder, who, along with his wife, is fully off the grid and making amazing ciders. And not only that, they've been doing this for quite a long time. I mentioned this cidery a number of episodes back as perhaps a cidery that you should know, but you don't know until now. So we'll get more to that chat in a moment. If you are a new listener to Cider Chat, well, welcome. Welcome to our spot in Ciderville, where even the lakes are filled with cider. And if you don't know what I mean, well, head on over to the Cider Chat Facebook page and go, I don't know, back a couple days, and you'll see a fun posting. It was actually pretty cool. It was taken on one of my sunset cider nights, which is typically Wednesday, because that's the day that I look to have this podcast live for you. And man, that photo just came out perfect. It looks like the cider is filling up the lake. And that's really how it happens in Ciderville. And while I'm talking about the Facebook page, I just want to say welcome to a couple new folks who joined in on some of the fun there, because I do post little things there that I don't necessarily post on the Twitter feed and try to keep a little bit of the social media separate, but sometimes it works that way, sometimes it doesn't. And those folks are, we have Chris from the UK, we have Natalia from Germany, and we have Chris and Mike. I believe they both work at Boss Key Production. Chris has a podcast too. And also Ali from the Netherlands, which I will be headed to quite soon in September. Can't wait to get over there and talk to some cider folks. And then also, hey, to Lou. I know you, Lou. Thank you so much for joining in and liking the page. And you should know this is not an exclusive for, you know, members only. If you'd like to join in on the conversation over there, go ahead, because I do have some recent conversations coming up in terms of what you might ask the president of the IDAC in France. And what does that stand for? Well, that is a governing board that oversees the production of cider, pommier, and calvados. And that, I'm not even going to try to, well, I'll try it. Okay, here I go. It's an interprofession des appellations cidercos. And that is, I'm reading it directly and doing my best. And what it means is that it's like the government board, kind of like what the different cider associations do around the world in terms of helping the production stuff. I have a feeling this is what they do, and we're going to get that info because I am meeting with the president when I'm going over on my kind of joint trip. I was able to kind of tuck in a meeting with Monsieur Bidou, who is actually a producer of Calvados and Pommier, and those are also apple products. If you're not familiar with them, they are in that like cider root region of Normandy, and he's going to take some time to fill us in on his two crafts there and giving us an idea of the structuring of that organization. I think it's going to be absolutely fantastic. And I'm working around a chat with Jerome DuPont of the DuPont Domain, that is a cider maker, also a very long-term lasting cidery in the Normandy region. Unfortunately, he's going to be in North America while I'm over in Europe. So we're not quite crossing paths, but we'll kind of meet up about that. And we'll also find out about how they are really giving that label that says this is a true Normandy cider. So there's going to be a couple neat chats coming up for all of us to kind of get the behind-the-scenes scoops of what's going on in France. And you probably, if you've been listening to Cider Chat for a while, you do know that I'll be there speaking with Eric Bordelais. And Eric, interestingly, his ciders are not under this appellation of the IDAC. I guess you might say he's a little bit of a rogue, and I could relate to that too. So I'm very, very curious about the take on all this. And doesn't this kind of happen around the world? There's different defined ways that, you know, you either go one path or the other. And I like to kind of consider that Cider Chat, we're kind of like looking at it all and trying not to be too judgmental. Although I have let my judgment go out a little bit in the terms of what I see as cider, in terms of real cider for myself, based in my part of Ciderville. And it's a little bit different how other people see it around the world. And interestingly, on this upcoming chat, you'll hear what Sebastian has to say, because he's originally from the UK, and what he was seeing on his trip over there in terms of cider and what they're looking at now and what the new hot topic is. So much going on out in the world of cider, in the land of Ciderville. So much fun and so many interesting tidbits. Okay, now what else did I want to talk about? I'm sure there's something else here, but this is a long chat, so I'm going to just hop right to it and let us join in on this conversation. I'm going to bring you in. You're going to take a little bit of the ride with me along to this amazing, and I can't say enough about this cider. It's really amazing because I'd done this trip in April where I went to see Farnham Hill. There's a part one, part two. You can listen to that. Last week was Shaxbury. I also spoke to Teddy Weber at Tin Hat. I'm not sure how that chat's going to go. We'll see if that comes up on a future one. Who knows? Could even be next week. We really don't know these things. And then I also talked to Adam Krakowski about his book on Vermont Prohibition. In that trip, I also took the trip out to Flag Hill, which is one of those places that you just can't get there from here. And that's what you're going to hear coming up as I introduce you into this chat. It's an amazing cidery. It's fully off the grid. It's certified organic. They have it going on there. And on top of that, they also have a little distillery. And can you imagine that? Doing that fully off the grid. Now, I do have a video that I'll be posting of Sebastian doing the little labeling so you can kind of see what's going on there. I don't know if I'll be able to get it up this week because, man, I got some stuff going on. But I'll put that out when I can and tag it along on Facebook so you can know once it's live on the Cider Chat YouTube channel. In the meantime, enough of this. Let's get to that. How about if you and I grab a glass and join this chat with Sebastian Lucider of Flag Hill Farm, Vermont Hard Cider.
Hooey, Ciderville, we almost got stuck in the mud. Not only is it crazy up here in Vermont, but I hit some heavy mud with a bit of snow. Had to back up, put it in low gear, and put the metal to the pedal. That is what it's all about sometimes, on the hunt for the perfect cider. And I think I'm somewhere up here. I'm not really sure if this is Flag Hill or what, but I'm going to go and do this little bit of exploring. Well, I'm going by a big building here. I don't even know if people live there. And I see what looks to be a very nice house in the distance. I have a feeling that might be Flag Hill. Got to put it in low and let it flow. You know, sometimes you speak in rhymes when you're like, out on the edge. It's all good. I hope they have a sign out for their little cidery, because I wouldn't know where I am. I mean, I've gone to some, like, off-the-beaten-path locations, but this is, like, right up there. It's so Vermont. So, so very Vermont. Sebastian!
Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you, too.
Sorry, we haven't had a sob up here for a little while.
Yeah.
that one corner is kind of bad, but were you okay?
I had to back up a little bit and put it in low and maneuvered it.
Uh-huh.
I live on a dirt road.
Uh-huh.
I don't live on this kind of dirt road, but it's like, okay, this is so Vermont.
My dog is friendly, but let me let him out before he goes nuts.
All right, I'm going to get my stuff out of the car. You've been doing this for quite a while.
We have almost an embarrassing amount of time.
what I was hoping to kind of give, you know, Ciderville a snapshot of the cidery, of the location, the beginning, and where you're kind of thinking about cider making, your skills and tips to share with other folks that are, a lot of listeners are thinking about starting cideries, or they just really love cider, you know, and don't want to make cider. They just want to enjoy and hear about some amazing ciders out in the world. Certainly your ciders do get distributed, you know, out. So, you know, I brought a bottle over to the Netherlands. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah. And you're a Brit, and you ended up in the U.S.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm half, my mother's American.
Oh, okay.
So, but I grew up in England.
Right.
And, I guess I'll start at the beginning, and you can prod me along if I get too off the track. I actually got really interested in winemaking when I was a child, actually, way before legal age. I just sort of liked the idea of gathering different country wine materials and elderflowers and elderberries, and I'm trying to think of other ones, walnut leaf wine and all sorts of weird things.
Walnut leaf wine.
Yeah, which is
I mean, is that with the...
It's actually leaves of the walnut trees, yeah.
Wow.
I have no idea. I don't remember what it tasted like. This was,
wow.
You know, but I used to brew up these things and try them on my parents, because I was probably around, you know, 13 or something like that. I wasn't really particularly into drinking myself. And they would usually make, you know, noises of horror when they tasted them. But at some point I made a pear wine that they thought was reasonably acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of went on. Well, it did that for a little while. And then I came to college over here in Maine and met Sabre there. And we were looking around. I was still, you know, was interested in apples, but not on a whole cider, you know, kit particularly.
Mm-hmm.
But we did end up, after graduation, we ended up picking apples for a couple of seasons, and that kind of got me more back into the idea of apples in particular. And when we were looking around, one thing I noticed in this country, at least compared to where I had grown up, was that apples just grow incredibly well here, and especially the wild trees. The fact that they were kind of part of the ecosystem, I thought was pretty exciting, really. Pretty different than England. Where I guess there's some regions it's like that, but nowhere that I'd ever been. I mean, they were basically planted apples. I still don't totally understand why that is, because there's plenty of apples in England, but you just don't see them popping up all over the place.
Maybe because it's been cultivated so many times.
Maybe.
Certainly this is a new country that's been, you know, recently colonized in terms of.
So we did the apple picking. We ended up coming to Vermont because Sabre had gone to the mountain school, which is just down the road, and we ended up having friends in the area. We actually initially were looking around all over the country, but it sort of basically honed in on a place that we had some connection, that she had some connection to. And so actually that first year, pretty much, that was in 84 or something like that, we made some friends. And at that point, cider was being made, you know, certainly not by everybody, but it was still really pretty popular in every little village, probably throughout New England. But I'm just going to let the dog out here.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we decided to think it was the first year to split making a barrel with these friends of ours. And it was a kind of social thing. We just gathered wild apples mainly. And there's a fabulous place to press cider in Washington, Vermont, Gingerbrook Firm, and Bob Machen there has an old hand-cranked press, large. I mean, it does 50 gallons to go.
Wow.
And it was quite a kind of meeting place of apple heads of various sorts. And so that added to the kind of whole social dimension. And actually one of the, at that point, we didn't even have a cellar or anything. We just would bring it in a barrel in the back of the house in the shade. And in fact, there was one time when the road crew came up, you know, grading the road, an, you know, older Vermonter road crew, and they were only too eager to hop off the grader and, like, taste the cider and everything. And pretty different. I don't think you, well, you might get that nowadays, but our current road crew are fantastic. Wouldn't do that, I don't think. So we did that. And actually, those friends of ours tried to do a mini cider business a few years later. When we bought this land, which is up at high elevation, I guess they were technically in the foothills of the Green Mountains, there were already, you know, there were a few cellar holes. And so there was a small orchard here already, but just about, I don't know, I'm thinking maybe like 30 trees or something that had been cultivated. So we planted some trees the very first year. At that point, we didn't know we were going to do hard cider particularly, but we knew we wanted to, you know, boost up the apple varieties. So I think we put in about 50 trees the first year. And then...
What year would...
That was 84, okay. I think. Those are all standard trees of, you know, esoteric kinds. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we made the cider for a few years. And at some point we were thinking about different crops we could grow. We had our Angora goats and various other things. But we thought about, you know, what we could use the land for. The soil is very thin, so it's not that many crops really you can grow here. Mm-hmm. So we decided, actually with some of the people we picked apples, to plant some more trees. We still have a tiny orchard, but we put in, you know, a few hundred trees, and they helped plant them. That was in 89.
Yeah, are those then cider?
Yeah, well, we have a big mix of varieties.
Okay.
So we don't specifically have... really cider varieties per se. I mean, we all of our ciders we use, you know, also wild apples in, so we kind of get the flavor from them. Mm-hmm, we basically mm-hmm. use the varieties that are here. So a lot of them are culinary or kind of dual purpose.
How far afield do you have to go to get your wild apples?
Well, we're certified organic, so it's quite specific the areas that we feel okay, you know, sort of permitted at this point to gather from. So we just gather from our own property, and then a few years ago, we also started getting apples from two different neighbors. And so, you know, one of them in particular has, you know, a number of wild trees, and he loves mowing, so it's an easy place to
nice.
To get lots of fruit.
Yeah.
So anyway, those trees, the especially the second batch of trees we put in, you know, started cropping, and we, at that point... decided to get our permit and become legal. I mean, we had, you know, made a little bit of cider to begin with.
So now we're looking at the late 80s?
Yeah, late 80s. I think in 96 might have been the first when we became bonded as a winery.
Okay.
So we'd made cider, obviously, after that for ourselves, but before that for ourselves, but mm-hmm. around that time. And at that point... The market was pretty hard work. I mean, we'd do tastings and things, and people were endlessly confused about whether it was, you know, had alcohol in it or not. And especially growing up in England, where cider always had alcohol in it, it was kind of a, you know, boring patter to, like, keep having to say, you know, no, you can't give it to the kids. Yes, it's, you know, this and that. And it actually sort of came at a time that the tradition, at least of the old time, is making cider in the villages and stuff, had sort of begun to taper down. And there's still, I mean, obviously some people kept doing it, but less people were doing it. Mm-hmm. So our first ciders, we actually spelt with a Y in the middle to help differentiate the people, at least would sort of say, why is it spelt like that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, initiate a question. And that was based on the very early English ciders that were supposedly the better quality ones, mm-hmm. had, you know, cider, C-Y-D-E-R. So we had, but we just sold in Vermont at that point. Mm-hmm. And we basically went on from there. I mean, now it's a whole different story. There's, you know, been an incredible rise in popularity, which is exciting, but also, you know, brings another dimension to the marketplace.
Absolutely. Yeah. So. I think that's kind of interesting that was the reason why you, I see that in your ciders. Uh-huh. I've seen that, like the CY.
Right.
And I was kind of curious about that. And this is a little bit of an interesting point for cider, especially at this stage, because of that clarification, like you said. And that's why people will say, well, hard cider, which is a very American term.
Right.
And you don't see that anywhere else. And thus, you know, the names go, like, what is it? And, you know, it, where I'm from, you know, I will really try to differentiate to people. This is sweet cider. I don't really typically call it apple juice. And then, but I grew up with everybody going to the cider mill and you grabbed your bottle of cider, which wasn't fermented. So, you know, as we're really catching up in this country in a way. And I don't know what's, you know, 5 years from now, maybe we'll still be at that point or it'll be regional. I really don't know. But
well, it was interesting. I hadn't been back to the UK for 5 years. And I, you know, just was there a couple of weeks ago. And now the big term is cloudy cider, but it actually is also for apple juice. But it's this whole thing of like, you know, not maybe not filtered, sort of looking less processed, but and that term was all over the place. I mean, for hard cider and sweet cider, and I was thinking, you know, often when I've been back there, you see something that then you see a few years later here. So I started thinking, well, maybe that's the next minor trend. I don't know, but when I was a kid, I mean, cider was the cheapest alcohol other than methylated spirits, which would eventually make you go blind. So all of the drunks, that was, you know, you'd see them sprawled on the bench almost always with a bottle of Woodbecker, you know, by their side or something like that.
Yeah.
And obviously there were better brands too, but so anyway.
So you started making cider, you got bonded, and I'm just kind of curious, at that point, you were producing one particular cider?
We started, well, when we began, I mean, I should start off that even now, you know, we're really tiny, like a good year, we make 4,000 gallons. And so we stayed pretty stable with that. We're really only sort of deeply interested in making ciders from our, from fruit that we've grown or like actually from the village that we're in. I'm not, you know, interested. I mean, at one point early on, we started, we didn't have apples 1 year and we bought like the very same variety grown somewhere else in Vermont. And the difference was just remarkable. I mean, they were just grown, you know, it was different cultivation methods. In fact, I sent down, because they were pressed elsewhere, we sent down barrels to fill at this cider mill. And I put in a couple of extra thinking, you know, just in case. And it ended up being these other apples were so much more watery that there was, I hadn't sent down nearly enough barrels. We dumped about 200 gallons on the ground. We had nothing to do with it because it was just, too, you know, very low sugar. And, you know, it got up here and I mean, I was able to use it eventually, but it was, it really was sort of eye-opening. But it was the same variety. I think it was like Jonna Gold or something that just grown differently. It was sort of IPM, you know, different soil. I didn't actually see the apples, so I don't know what the, you know, what the story was. But so we're pretty interested in that. And then we've also been, although we haven't been certified since the beginning, you know, we're also committed to organic growing, which is fairly, well, and also organic cider making, which that was the other thing. Actually, it was interesting in the UK that when I was there, I wasn't able to attend it, but there was a large sort of festival or whatever, just of natural wines, like natural and organic. And so I do think that that is going to be coming. People are going to start to pay more attention to that. At this point, you know, that people, it tends to be that people may go out on a, you know, be eating a portion of organic foods, but when it comes to wine, they're not, you know, usually that picky. They don't think about it that much. But I think that is more of an awareness that's going to be coming.
Absolutely. When you started selling the cider locally, what was the response? What's the Vermont cider drinker like?
Well, I guess to be honest, I mean, our best market was probably tourists. You know, people coming to Vermont looking for something special. And so that was probably our easiest outlet. And then, of course, you've got local people. I mean, one thing we did find, and it's now totally different, but in those days it was like if somebody hadn't tasted cider before, you'd get, you know, often these hideous looks on their face when they tasted our cider. And we could actually, we don't do this anymore, but back then we'd say, have you ever tasted cider before? And if they hadn't, you come, you know, you might brace yourself. And a lot, some people liked it, but you'd get, you know, definitely more people going, what the heck is this? They don't have a sort of handle on a taste. There's no familiarity. And that was really different because in Europe, you know, definitely not everybody likes cider, but at least when I was growing up, I mean, everybody had tasted cider. Everybody. I mean, you know, at some point it was always sort of strangely now, but it was always the, if once, you know, adults let their kids have alcohol, cider was usually the first thing they'd let them taste. And now actually looking at the, back then you couldn't post the alcohol contents on things, but now you, now I guess it's required. And so it's a little curious because a lot of the cider is actually a lot stronger than the beers. But anyway, so that's, you know, that was the initial reaction. Now, of course, that's changed. And, you know, a lot of people have tasted the, like, wood chuck or something like that, one of the more popular things. And ours is pretty different than that. But I would say we'd have those tourists, and then we'd have also local, you know, people that were familiar with cider. And then quite often people that traveled a bit, you know, and had cider somewhere else, that tended to be the people that would be interested. And even then, of course, the local foods thing was, you know, wasn't in existence. You know, there was, so now there's much more interest and people are kind of more open and they're thinking, you know, they'd like to like local everything that they can.
Sure. That's the way to go. Yeah. Like that farm to table and really supporting local agricultural endeavors.
Right.
How do you explain cider to folks? Do you have like a classic, like, you know, that new person who's never like, what's cider?
Well, I mean, we usually, you know, differentiate it between, we give them the apple juice, hard cider story. And of course, you know, we'll say it's a traditional drink of New England. And then, you know, the main thing at this point is to explain that it just runs an enormous gamut from, you know, super sweet, low alcohol, you know, factory made to sort of artisanal, you know, high end stuff. And so just because they like or dislike ours doesn't mean that they would like or dislike, you know, other ciders. Mm-hmm. So that's usually what we say. Mm-hmm. And it seems to work.
I'm always kind of curious what the opening line is, you know, for each cider maker to say that.
I mean, now it's so popular. You don't need, I mean, I was at an event last year. And I was, we were lined up next to, well, it was actually, there's a brewery right next to us. There's a whole big tasting thing. And I noticed more people were having beer than cider. I thought, well, that's fair enough because more people drink beer. And at some point you know, plenty of people were sampling us or getting glasses. And at some point I wandered away from my little tent. And that particular event, I think there were, you know, 12 cider makers and 3 breweries. And so, you know, that was pretty eye-opening. And that was just Vermont, local places.
Wow.
So at this point, there's no explanation needed anymore. I mean, people, you know, there's nobody new. I mean, once, I think a year ago, we did one where, you know, somebody took the cider and tried to give it to their child, and we had to say, stop, you know. They were kind of, actually, they were European, and they thought it was okay. There was nothing wrong with that, you know.
Okay, yeah.
But, yeah, there's no explanation needed, I wouldn't say, at this point.
You've been in this for a while. What have you seen with the trends over the years? I mean, initially, people didn't know. Now there's no explanation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But was there a point that you started seeing, wow, there's like an uptick here?
Uh-huh.
And what year that might be? or was there anything noticeable that happened?
I'm trying to remember, really. I mean, it's been sort of, I'd say the real explosion has been, it seems to me anyway, it's been the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, it was sort of slowly, you know, we started about the same time as Farnham Hill. And at that point, you know, it was just a few, other than, you know, Woodchuck and some of the English imports.
There
was,
West,
you know,
County.
Yeah, or West, yeah, County, right. It was, you know, pretty minimal. But so I'd say the last couple of years has been a big, you know, big explosion. And probably, I mean, I hate to say it, probably too many. I mean, I think at some point it will sort of whittle down, because I think it's a little bit like the microbrewery thing that was in the, I guess it was sometime in the late 80s or early 90s when there was a whole lot of Vermont breweries, like a few too many, and they, like Catamount was one of the first ones around here.
Sure.
And eventually they couldn't also, for whatever reason, it was a sort of weird little sort of explosion in interest, and then people actually went back to mainstream for a while. I don't think that's going to happen, because I think that people are still, you know, now interested in more local products, and, you know, so.
Right, the opportunity is there.
Yeah.
And I think, but it has to be approached as a business, because it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some really progress and some don't. And it has nothing to do with cider itself,
right,
you know, in that way.
Right.
I think that's a good starting point to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I'm hearing that, like, you know, it's just this influx of people. It's just incredible. And there's so much excitement. And, of course, with the world economy, you are able to bring in juice.
Right.
And some folks are making some really great product in urban cideries.
Mm-hmm, right.
And, you know, that's something that we're seeing a lot of now.
Yeah.
So, I guess we're all kind of wondering, like, 5 years from now, and hopefully it'll keep on going up. At least that's what I'm hoping for.
Uh-huh.
I wonder, initially, your cider making, were you approaching it from like that English style?
Well, has we actually did the, or? No, I mean, we did kind of the New England style, which was the, made in an oak barrel, an old whiskey barrel.
Right.
And at that point, the whiskey barrels were basically free. I mean, there was no, I think it was the planter market that put an end to that, but all you'd pay for was the trucking. And so there was a local outfit that would charge $20 a barrel, and they were taking a truck down to, you know, Kentucky to fill it up with barrels. And there was enough interest then that they bring one tractor trailer load a year, and, you know, local cider makers would go down to Lebanon, give them the $20, you know, get the barrel.
Yeah.
And I guess with the planter thing, and then also I guess they started exporting barrels, you know, overseas more, whatever. Suddenly there was a price on them, plus they're heavy to ship. And so, but we did start with that, and that was definitely the traditional method around here. You know, had a strong whiskey overtone. You were very happy if you got, you know, the barrel with still a little bit of whiskey in it. Mm-hmm. You definitely didn't, you know, rinse that out usually. Mm-hmm. And over time, we have changed. I mean, we got more interested in the fruit and less interested in the whiskey, and that, you know, at the same time that the barrels got pricier. And probably our biggest influence was Lou Nichols and Annie Prue, who wrote the Hard Cider Bible, in my opinion. And they lived in Versailles. Lou still has a place here. And so, you know, we visited him a little bit, and he was actually the first person I saw making cider in the plastic apple, you know, plastic barrels. And I was sort of horrified at the beginning. I thought, this is, you know,
plastic barrels.
Like apple concentrate barrels.
Oh, okay.
The blue plastic 60-gallon barrels. And because those have become the kind of cheap, you know, thing you could buy locally that was food grade and everything. So we kind of tentatively explored using those, and we did use them, you know, ended up finding that the results were actually pretty decent. So we kind of switched over to that. And so then that was definitely, you know, taking the oak factor away, or the whiskey factor away. Mm-hmm. And we haven't changed too much from that. We make three different ciders at this point. We did tail it. I mean, initially all our ciders were dry. We kind of, well, going back a bit, so those first ones were still ciders, you know, with a sort of whiskey taste in a wine bottle. Mm-hmm. And then we started making a champagne method one. Mm-hmm. That was the next one. And at that point, I realized that, you know, when we do the tastings, not everybody likes dry. So we sort of ended up sweetening the still cider we make has 1% residual sugar. So that's sort of like slightly off dry. And then a couple of years ago, we started making a kind of Belgian beer style one.
Well, I want to talk to you about that one. And that's a sapsucker.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting that, you know, and on the label it says Belgian beer style. Mm-hmm. So how did you fuse that concept into cider making? Because I'm also a craft beer writer. So I know a little bit about beer. That's an interesting descriptor for because when I actually taste a sapsucker, you know, I am getting that very floral, but it's also farmy. And so what's the poetry there in calling it a Belgian, you know, beer style?
I guess
is that like a branding piece too?
No, I mean, the yeast we use is a Belgian yeast, and it's cider on lees. So there's yeast, you know, that's the main thing. I mean, so when we started, well, not before we were making it for sale, the standard method was brew the stuff in the whiskey barrel. There was just a set amount of sugar you'd add to boost up the alcohol content, and which I think was 15 pounds. We'd do it like in, you know, three times, you'd add 5 pounds over the course of the winter. And then when you bottled it, we used to put in actually a couple of raisins in each bottle. And I don't think we added any sugar to the bottle. We would just wait until the barrels had slowed down, until the fermentation was, you know, had slowed down almost the whole way. Put in, you know, a couple of raisins and bottle it up, and it would be lightly fizzy, yeasty, you know, cider with these things that looked like goat droppings that would, you know, come out of the bottle, which was less appetizing. But we knew we couldn't sell that. I mean, maybe now you could. We've thought about that, but at that point, that wasn't marketable. But we did think about, just when we were thinking about making a bubbly one, we were imagining it would still have the yeast in it, you know. And in fact, we visited the Borough Hill Cidery in England, Julian Templey, and, you know, he was doing the champagne method at that point there. And So he gave us a little tour and everything, and he just said, you know, probably 50 times when we were there, you know, you've got to get the shit out of the bottle. And, he, you know, again and again and again. So we kind of marched out of there, and it just sort of like embedded in our head. We came back, okay, well, I mean, he knows, I guess we have to get the yeast out of the bottle. So that's what actually started the champagne method division.
Well, why did he say get
well, it out get, in other words, the yeast, in other words, not sell it with the yeast in it.
But, because
well, just because you're making a stylistically. I mean, he was making a, you know, if it's a champagne bottle, sort of high-end product, I think he was selling it, you know, I don't know if it was Fortnum and Mason's, but, you know, high-end places at that point, people don't expect, they didn't expect, you know, yeast in it.
Right.
So we did that for quite a while. And it's a lot of labor. I like doing that, but it's quite a lot of labor, although we've got a lot better at doing it, so it's less daunting. But mainly because of the champagne tax, we decided, which is, you know, the hard cider over a certain alcohol content, mm-hmm. especially in the beginning, all hard cider was classified as sparkling wine if it had, you know, bubbles in it. So it's a huge amount of tax. So when we think about, you know, it made sense to think about something less bubbly and less labor. So since all of our ciders are bottle conditioned, we don't, you know, it's, they're not artificially carbonated. You know, you get yeast in the bottle from that. So that's kind of how it started. And so the, apart from using a Belgian beer yeast for the secondary fermentation, we were also thinking it, at that point, people expect on a Belgian beer that there will be sediment in it. So it's sort of, I'd seen ones from Canada, you know, where it says cider on lees, we could have said that too.
Right. And just for listeners who don't really understand that, when you're saying on the lees, what are you meaning
there? Well, it's the yeast deposit. So normally, when things, you know, when you do a fermentation, the yeast does its stuff and finally settles down, you know, in the bottom in a sediment that's can get stirred up usually pretty easily and murky. Some people actually like the taste of that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we've found with this one, when we tell people, you know, you can either let this cider settle and pour it carefully and the yeast sediment will stay at the bottom, or some people actually like it. Some people stir it up on purpose.
Right.
With the champagne method, because champagne, the champagne style is considerably more bubbly, those bubbles stir up the yeast. So you can't get a clear, unless you super chilled it, you can't pour off a clear, you know, product. That's a big difference. The sap sucker is less bubbly. So if you, you know, if you're careful and you chill it, it pretty much stays at the bottom.
Right. I mean, that's kind of like a Hefeweizen, where some, you know, folks are taught, like, shake that bottle.
Right.
You know, it's just kind of...
Yeah.
Gray area,
and
it's really goes to the taste of the drinker in that way. And I think the cidery gets to choose whether or not how they want to produce that.
Mm-hmm.
What your palate's telling you as a cider maker, Sebastian, what you'd like to do.
Yeah, and we also had trouble sort of not, I mean, we've always sold everything we've produced, but the champagne one, we kept running into people that said, oh, I've got a bottle of that, you know, still in the fridge. Like, it was only being saved for a special occasion because it looked too fancy. And so that was another reason we came up with the third one that's, you know, just a beer cap and less fancy looking, because although, you know, we don't really like to hear that they've had it sitting there waiting for that special occasion that, you know,
may I think it's a great cider. I really, I like it, you know, as I like to introduce people and by, you know, offering the sapsucker. And it was fun bringing it over to, across the pond.
Yeah, so actually, I was thinking back when you mentioned traveling, because the other thing that happened is, so a few years ago, probably starting 5 years ago, we started getting like all these visitors, I mean, from global, I mean, just all over the place. And
coming all the way up here.
Well, not just, you know, they'd be on like a cider, they just would be, a lot of them were from this country, from other parts of this country, thinking about opening a cidery, so they'd be touring around.
Wow.
And then we had, I'm trying to think, you know, English, Scandinavia, trying to remember where else, some Australians, you know, different people, but we get, you know, a sort of a steady trickle.
Yeah.
And we are very honored to have the retired cider maker from Bulmers visit. I mean, he was visiting Farnham Hill.
Alan Tringham.
And that was pretty fun. But other than that, so there's all these people coming to check us out. And everyone else, that's has pretty much stopped at this point. And we're also less interested in it, because at some point we, like, you know, did a couple of workshops and everything, and, you know, suddenly then it's just like feeding new competitors, which has, you know, is a mixed blessing.
Yeah, right, right. Did Alan come with anyone?
With the Samuel Adams
group. I met him that same year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he came to my cider making workshop, and he was on tour. He had done the Cider Days.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that was, might have been accompanied by Grant Wood,
maybe,
who was the cider maker at that point.
Right.
Who's now, I think, down in Texas or something. That's cool.
Yeah, that was cool. And, of course, Cider Days. I mean, we haven't been able to attend recently, but, you know, I think it was incredibly generous of the West County people to sort of start that thing from the very beginning, just to be open, and it didn't feel like a competitive. It was sort of like camaraderie. And, you know, that's had, an enormous impact.
Absolutely.
We unfortunately usually can't attend because it's so late in the, it seems really late in the season, but a lot of our apples are really, really late, and it tends to be like our craziest time. You know, right around then, but we will get back there. We've sent ciders down there and everything. It's just to be in a big apple year. It's like, seems not possible, but.
right, because you're an integral part of that, certainly. You know, I see Flag Hill as being a big part of those beginning cider makers in that way. So I hope you can make it again and you know, give a talk, not teach, but just talk and kind of inform people because you create a marker in so many ways that is that oral history of this country for cider. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
It's a treasure in that way. It really is. The Cider Act that's kind of coming in effect in 2017. You were talking about the sparkling. Is that going to change a little bit about?
Well, I guess I'm going to have to decide. I mean, the reason because our apples are organically grown and so without the use of very much fertilizer and very late season apples generally, which we purposefully have sort of sought out, you know, planted and have been sought after because their flavors are just, you know, richer, I think much better. Mm-hmm. So that's the plus. The minus is, you know, we're sometimes pressing, occasionally picking in the snow and other nutty things. So there's a kind of balance there. I'm realizing now earlier
is better. There's snow on the ground now. It's going to be May, like in a couple of days.
Yeah.
And the snow must start flying in like sometimes September.
Occasionally.
Yeah.
So where was I going with that? Oh, yeah, the Cider Act. So the New England tradition that we started with, you always added some sugar to boost the alcohol content up. Mm-hmm. And being organic, you know, not adding sulfites, I did, you know, for instance, Lou Nichols, some of the best cider I ever tasted was something that he produced that was like a Baldwin and russet mix of some sort. And I kept hounding him to give me another bottle. And at some point, it's about a year later, I had some. And at that point, he didn't add sugar to anything. It was just, you know, and I tasted like it was a few years later, but the taste had just like gone. And I realized, well, the alcohol, you know, is such a preservative of flavor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So because we are interested, I mean, cider already has a great shelf life compared to fruit, selling, you know, tree fruit. Yeah. But, you know, we have a certain, you know, we wanted a pretty good shelf life without refrigeration. So we do make sure our cider is some of the strongest ciders out there. And we definitely have some apples that we can press, you know, cider that's, we've pressed some before that's like 9% potential alcohol, you know, right off the tree. But then that's not all of them. So we kind of keep it around 8.5%. With the Cider Act, I guess we're going to have to make a decision because our sparkling is around 9.5%. And so we'll have to make a decision. Do we lower the alcohol content a little bit? I certainly wasn't about before all of this. Actually, before I started making the sapsucker, I thought, well, I could just start watering the cider down, you know, a juice down to make something that's legal. And I actually made a few test bottles of that, and I thought, this is, you know, rubbish. I'm not going to, there's no way I'm going to do that.
Mm.
So I guess I haven't made up my mind yet on that. Mm. I suppose probably I should start to, you know, tailor the sparkling down so it's below the limit.
Mm-hmm.
Because the tax is considerable. I mean, it's $3.40 a proof gallon compared to, I think, I'm paying, you know, pennies, basically zero on the other stuff. I consider it zero tax. I mean, other people wouldn't say so, but.
Right. You know, you're making 4,000 gallons of cider per year. Do you sell out? I mean, in many ways, do you have to, like, meet that market? I know, like, in market terms, if you don't have your product there, like, year-round, then you lose that shelf space. And that's a really key piece.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things with cider, it's not really in that table wine price.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a lot higher than that. Mm-hmm. Your ciders, you know, go in that range depending on where you're going to get it.
Right.
And so you could lose drinkers by having too high of a, mm-hmm. a price mm-hmm. scale. How does that come in for you as a
Well, seller? I mean, it has changed. The market is changing, and I'm going to be really interested to see what happens in the next year or two because it's changed a lot. I mean, until a couple of years ago, we just sold within the state of Vermont, and we didn't even have that many outlets. It was just, maybe 20 different places that we sold, and that would take care of everything. And starting last year, I mean, partly our trees have grown, so we have a little more production, but starting last year, we started distributing in Massachusetts as well. Mm-hmm. And if we hadn't done that, we would have just been hammered. Like, we're still in the same places in Vermont, but there's just enough competition that, you know. And to be fair, I mean, you think if you go out to buy wine or beer, I mean, you know, most people buy a selection of brands. I mean, some people just get obsessed on one brand. So,
sure.
So I'm going to be interested in the next year to see whether, you know, we have to basically we're probably having to expand our distribution range, you know, a bit more or do more marketing. I mean, we've kind of become a little bit complacent. Perhaps in the beginning we, you know, did farmers markets and things like that and more events. Mm-hmm. And then we sort of stopped doing that. And now, you know, I guess we're going to have to start doing some things like that.
Yeah, especially when you're seeing, you know, cider in cans.
Right. Yeah, we thought about doing the cans. I mean, one thing... We thought pretty seriously about doing cans because everybody else is. And you kind of think, well, maybe I should be doing it. Mm. And actually, when I looked into it, I got pretty concerned about, you know, that people don't realize that all the cans are plastic lined. And there's BPA and, you know, many of those linings. Mm. And I guess the cider is more acidic than beer. So it's, you know, I had no idea about that. But I started looking into it and then, you know, running into what has to be a special lining. And finally, I found, and then at that point... Because
what is BPA?
Oh, well, let's say, I'm not going to, I think it's...
It's a very chemical term, isn't it, that people have a lot of concern about leaching
right,
out
yeah, I think it's,
products.
I'm not exactly sure if it,
especially
if it keeps
children
it plastic,
and,
right. I mean, it's something they're trying to phase out of water bottles and everything
that's
else.
That's right, yeah.
It's like bisphenol A or something, I may not be saying
right.
It right,
and that's why not to reuse your water bottles.
Right, exactly.
Okay, yeah.
I've heard that, I've talked to a chemist who said that was rubbish, that, you know, the water bottle, because we had started... You know, I'd heard that, and we weren't reusing them.
Yeah.
But basically, if it hasn't leaked, anyway, that's a sort of aside. But certainly, you don't really want it. And so people don't realize that it's a plastic container. And there was, I think, little oversight of what that, you know, what that lining is. And the linings have to be tailored. So beer isn't very acidic, and I think it's relatively easy to contain. But I guess cider and wine will eat right through the can, you know, if it's not careful. Wow. And so when I was looking into it, there's only a few can manufacturers, and... They, at least the ones that I was talking to, have stopped selling plain cans that you can stick a label on because they want to know what people are putting into it. And so they, you know, they wanted to print the labels and everything. And then you run into with, so I finally found a can I was interested in using and then, and you know, kind of excited thinking, well, you know, this could be good. And suddenly they said, well, actually in California, it's run into BPA issues, minor, but it's in the light, you know, blah, blah, blah. And at that point, I just thought, you know, no, I'm done. I'm going to do glass. I mean, you can argue the aluminum is, you know, people do recycle that. As long as it's, you know, using a high portion of recycled, that probably has a less of a carbon footprint than, you know, heavy bottles. Mm-hmm. But that's a pretty complicated equation. But basically when I added in the plastic thing, I thought it's too many unknowns. And considering I'm an organic product, I'm not really having that much trouble selling it. I don't think I need to do this. Mm-hmm. I would like lighter boxes as I get older.
Yeah, I mean, just kind of the shipping cost is a lot higher, too, with glass versus cans.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you have different bottle sizes, right? Because Sapsucker is... What is that?
Oh, those are actually all 750. I've thought about doing small. Yeah, it looks small. It looks like it's sort of 22 ounces.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's bigger than a 22-ounce bottle, definitely.
Right.
But, that and coming all the way up here, I'm just wondering, how are you trucking it out of here? I saw a Jeep, but you got to have something else.
Yeah, well, we've had quite a bit of excitement with our, receiving bottles. Receiving bottles is usually more of an issue than getting product out because we're usually taking stuff out, in smaller quantities over time. But certainly getting bottles up here. We've had two tractor trailers get stuck on our road over the years.
I can't even imagine a tractor trailer coming around that corner.
No, it's when they haven't somehow the chain of communications broken down because they're meant to meet us in town and all this other stuff. And so that's been, we've had some, that gets a little tiresome at times. But So we've thought about moving off-site, but it's, you know, incredibly handy when we're pressing apples and everything. In fact, we didn't press apples here until maybe 5 years ago, and before that we trucked the apples to be pressed. And at the end of the season, you know, I sort of tallied up the miles driven, you know, to do that, and that's when we started realizing it'd be better to press them, you know, on-site.
Right. So. And plus you have so total control.
Right, exactly.
On-site, you get to do maceration if you want to.
Right.
Letting the apple sweat and really go to that perfect sugar content.
Right.
So that's a really key piece. Yeah. I imagine that is the fun of making cider. You give up that most, I mean, it's fun to watch it go, but to do that pressing so you know, oh, we're making the perfect press. It's just too good, you know, why let that go? So I could see that. And, you know, I was talking to Neil Worley, Worley Cider in the UK. And he trucks the apples up. It takes about an hour via tractor up to the site.
Oh, wow.
Because they can't grow the apples on the site because of the soil. It's not really conducive. Mm-hmm. But there's these great orchards down the old Taunton cider orchards. Fantastic for him. Mm-hmm. Low nutrient apples, really exactly what he wants. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, you know, here's this cider maker is importing out to the world and bringing those apples up in a tractor, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
That's just what it is. It's part of agriculture.
Yeah,
and,
right.
What the farmer, the orchardist, you know, it's an interesting thing. And I don't know, I just think a backhoe and kind of, you know, straighten out that curve and you'd be golden. But,
well, we did have it. Actually, the worst curve on the road was straightened out. At one point for a logging job.
That's straight?
relatively straight. And, you know, we were with great anticipation. This was a key part of the logging job, was to get a certain size logging truck, a tractor trailer, logging trailer up here. And suddenly, you know, we heard this incredible noise and this truck came up. We thought, amazing, you know, they've made it. That was worth it and everything else. And they kind of raced into the steep field we've got, did an incredibly fast 360 and left. And I sort of stopped them on the road and I said, you know, what's going on? They said, well, we made it up, you know, empty. There's no way we'd, you know, tackle that full. Wow. And sorry, you know.
We're not doing it.
Yeah, you find a smaller truck. So, but yeah, I mean, I love the linear. I mean, for me, I love the apple growing, you know, all the way up through the whole thing. I mean, some of it, you know, there's obviously drudgery at different points of it, but there's a satisfaction, you know, for sure.
Do you do this all by yourself, or do you have apprentices who come up or interns?
We have had interns, some really great interns over the years. And then, you know, in picking season, we have a few people help. Mm-hmm. And we only have a few acres of apples, so it's usually looks.
Doable.
Yeah, people that in the beginning, you know, you see these interns or people helping, and they just can't believe you could possibly pick all the apples. But as long as the weather cooperates, you know, we usually get it done.
Do you pick them? You don't let them drop?
We shake them.
Okay.
Yeah. We usually, I mean, the other thing that's changed a little bit is in the beginning, we would definitely take out some more fruit for eating. I mean, because we're certified organic, there was a pretty good market, sort of premium price. And at that point, there weren't the California organic apples or organic apples from, you know, that. Mm. So you could put an apple in the marketplace that had a blemish or two and, you know, a certain sector would buy those. And so now we do less of that. We sell, you know, sometimes we can't resist, you know, picking the best ones. But basically, we have a lot of different varieties. I mean, I haven't tallied it up recently, but, you know, at one point we had over 80 varieties, and we certainly trialed more than that. So the ripening thing is a bit of insanity, you know, trying to make sure the sort of peak time to pick them. So we usually, we put tarps on the ground and shake the trees, and it's pretty primitive.
Wow.
And do it that way.
Well, why not?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's... Do you actually shake the tree?
Yeah, we
with
shake
your hands?
The tree. Yeah, we get up in the tree and shake it, and we sometimes have, you know, pruning poles. We shake it with and that's fun. I mean, you know, basically
just part of the joy of making cider. That's fantastic. I love it. Now you also have something that you're making the Palm de Vie.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So we started distilling. In fact, this property was well known in the region for having a still on it. I mean, we did find some remnants of it, but apparently there was during Prohibition, there was a guy, his name was Police Drooge, which was a fantastic name, and he had a sort of pack of savage dogs that would basically bark and distract people enough, and there were supposedly the stack of the still came up through a hollow porcupine tree. and it was sort of camouflaged by this hollow tree.
I love it.
So there was some, you know, history here. I mean, there's still people around all over the place in Vermont, you know, making their own, distilling their own stuff. But I guess, you know, at one point before the people moving out west, I mean, there were hundreds of apple of distilleries, mainly doing apple in, just in the state of Vermont. So
1,600 distilleries.
So, oh, really? Yeah, something ridiculous.
And now there's only 16 distilleries in Vermont.
Yeah.
That was like the pre-prohibition thing. I just learned that last night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that was quite something. So we began doing the brandy shortly after the cider. I don't know, as if you know. And just as a way to use up more of our fruit, basically, sometimes you get some, it wasn't cider that's bad, but cider that wouldn't mix into the blend. Right. I mean, initially when we did our cider, when we were learning, we'd ferment all the varieties separately and in barrels and then do, you know, a sort of master blend of some sort. And now we don't do it quite that way. I kind of do different categories and, you know, now enough. But so we'd get some that were less suitable for the blend, maybe too acidic or whatever it was. And so we started making the brandy and just selling that within Vermont. And that was, I think we were the fourth distillery, only the second one in operation when we began. I mean, there'd been a couple, somebody making spruce, some sort of spruce alcohol and a whiskey one. This is all before the micro distillery kind of boom. Mm-hmm. And so we started at the same time as the vodka people in St. Johnsbury.
Interesting. And, is there a licensing thing that goes on there that gets a little catchy?
Oh, yeah. Being farm? Oh, the farm was okay. But at some point, the distillery is a separate whole permit.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, different bonds that protect the potential tax revenue that the federal government may gain from your product. And at some point they said that one of the bonds, it's a standard bond, is something called a transit bond, which covers the potential loss of revenue when product is moved from one location to another, i.e. like trucking it in someplace. And they started saying to me that I needed a transit bond. And when I said, well, I'm only pumping it through a 2x4 wall, they still like kept on that for quite a while. I was just pumping it from the winery to the distillery, which is, you know, just a separate bit of the same building.
Right.
They eventually gave up on that. But the permitting, the distillery is a lot more permitting and record keeping. And
do the suits come up here?
Yeah, they've come up twice. And each time they've usually been, you know, more nervous than I am.
Because they're like all the way up.
Because they're all the way out. I mean, and I don't know how it is now, but they, you know, were covering all explosives and, you know, tobacco, just incredibly overextended. And they'd come up here and between the distance and their car, we, at that point, we had a really big dog that would bark a lot. And they, you know, it was, they, you know, one guy was literally shaking when he got here. So I sort of felt, you know, a little better about it. And it's all, you know, at that point, predominantly paperwork, you know, and that would be computer, but I mean, that was like files of paperwork that if you had was what they really, you know, that's what they were looking for.
You know, I remember when the Homeland Security got kicked in after 9/11, mm-hmm. that a lot of cider makers were getting visits from suits.
Uh-huh.
And at least down where I am, you know, intimidating
some people
pretty badly, you know, because they wanted to know, like, how many chickens you had and you know, everything. And, of course, and then it would came where, you know, there was so much structure around the cider house.
Uh-huh.
And there's one cidery I know of that those apple trees are still there. And the guy just got so fed up because he had, like, a really ancient, old, beautiful, beautiful, perfectly working press.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't in, like, the sanitation level.
Uh-huh.
He was selling the sweet cider.
Sweet cider, okay.
See, you know, that press, perfect for a cider maker.
Right.
Right? Because you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, we've been lucky that the, so with alcohol anyway, that the Agriculture Department is less involved. And certainly, you know, hearing about people in the EU, I remember when England, you know, joined the common market, suddenly, you know, hearing stories about inspectors coming to places making, you know, I don't know, if a smoked salmon or cheeses and saying, oh, no, no, you know, these places that have made the thing products for hundreds of years and suddenly being told, you know, no, it has to be stainless steel and this and that and the other thing. And I don't know how that is now, but we've been lucky not to have had issues with that.
Yeah, well, one of the great reasons to be up on Flag Hill. This is Flag Hill, right?
Yeah, there's actually there's actually another Flag Hill winery in New Hampshire. We both started at the same time, and it's both the same story, that somebody climbed a hill and, like, tied something up. so that they could, or a flag, you know, to see if they could see it from their home. And so that's the hill is another number of hundreds of feet higher than this, but that's how it started.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I was wondering where that name came from.
Yeah.
And is there confusion around that because there's a New Hampshire?
Yeah, I mean, there was, you know.
But they don't make cider.
I don't think they make cider, but initially there was confusion, mainly when I'd order products. You know, once in a while I get there, you know, merchandise was meant to be for them.
Oh, my goodness.
I guess they'd sometimes get it for us and.
You're almost on the same, like, you know, if you threw a line over to New Hampshire, right?
Right.
As the crow flies.
Yeah. So that seems to have got sorted out. I mean, at some point we got like an acceptance letter for some preschool for our grandson that I think ended up in New Hampshire. But other than that, it seems like we've coexisted, you know, relatively well, and it hasn't been an issue. I mean, a big issue.
Well. So. That's what happens up north sometime, right? You just got to go with the flow.
Right.
I would like to thank Sebastian Lesider of Flag Hill Farm in Vermont. What an amazing tale. And the fact that he has been making cider for so long off the grid, that just blows my mind. I actually didn't realize that when I first went to his home. I thought, oh, yeah, a nice little homestead on top of the mountain where the vista, when we walked out to the orchard area, and there is a snapshot of that on the show notes for this, so that's at episode 44, you could see the White Mountains in New Hampshire. That was pretty spectacular, too. But I had no idea until we then left his home and drove back towards the large barn that I had originally passed on my way in, on the entrance there, and then started looking around, put two and two together when I saw the solar panels, and that's when I realized this place is off the grid. And I think the interesting point here is that when you become used to that lifestyle and running a business like that, you just kind of take it as second nature. This is what they do. They're not thinking, oh, we're off the grid every single day. This is how they live their life. And they do it so well. If you have not had a chance to have Flag Hill Farms cider, the sapsucker, the dry, amazing cider, you could taste the organic, you could taste the love and affection that this man is doing for the work that he has been doing for quite a while. Check it out. I have the contact there. Follow up. My fingers are crossed that we might be able to get Sebastian to come on down to Cider Days this coming November. And again, I will be having a chat about that coming up to give you a little bit of an inside scoop on what I recommend if you are attending Cider Days the first weekend of November. Thank you so much, Sebastian. Cheers to both you and Sabra for a fruitful coming year. If you enjoy these chats with cider makers from around the world, please support Cider Chat via Patreon. You could find the link at ciderchat.com. And there's also a donate button there, too, if you prefer to support the chat that way. Well, next week, we'll be rolling out to Ciderville again. I'm looking forward to chatting with you and finding out some more tales from around the world. In the meantime, have a great week. May it be filled with cider and good cheer. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. I look forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Going up, going up.